Hello and welcome everyone. In today's show, which is episode 7, myself and Gregor are talking to Michael Ryan. But firstly, let's catch up on what we've been up to this week. So Gregor, what have you been up to this week?
Likewise, I've been busy helping a customer with some Dynamics business central work and writing design documents for a couple of our customers. I also took part in a talk, the DevOps Knots user group, with a good friend of mine, Thomas Thornton. We were talking about Terraform and using Azure DevOps. And last night, I hosted the Glasgow Azure user group, where we had two awesome speakers. Tricia Sinclair was showing us Azure boards and some awesome features and plugins that I hadn't seen before. And then we had Barbara Forbes from the Netherlands. She was talking about automating Azure, making the portal work for you. So lots of CLI and PowerShell and things like that. Lots of great tips. Yeah, so it was great. And we rounded it off with a quiz and someone won a webcam. So all in all, it's been a great week. What about yourself, Richard? What have you been up to?
So this is my last week where I currently work, which is awesome. Obviously, when this podcast goes live, I would actually have completed my first day at my new job. So everyone should know exactly where I am if they haven't guessed already. So this week, I've pretty much been finalizing my handover stuff. I actually had to fix a few issues today and show people how SSRS works and send in emails and stuff like that, which was fun because it broke, so I had to fix it, and you know, I do like to troubleshoot. So apart from that, really, I missed the two user groups that you had planned, which was a shame because they sounded awesome. Hopefully, maybe they were on, like maybe I can catch them up on demand or something. I think the Azure one, the Glasgow one, is always available on YouTube afterwards, isn't it? Yep. Cool. Not sure about the Knots one, so I might reach out to the organizers and find out.
Yeah, that's on YouTube as well.
Oh, awesome. Brilliant. So yeah, the rest of the week I'm going to be watching them. It's Halloween this weekend, so lots of Halloween movies planned. A bit of Hocus Pocus. AWS. Scariest thing I know. But apart from that, not much really, just lots of handover work and getting excited for my new job.
Cool. New job Monday, that'll be good. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, definitely. A bit nervous, obviously, but super excited and raring to go.
Good. Looking forward to finding out where you go.
I'm sure you know. Cool.
Right. So send that on and I'll do a wee bit of editing. That's cool.
Cool.
Welcome, everyone. So today we are joined by Michael Ryan. Michael is the EMEA manager for the Microsoft Azure engineering team, and he lives in Dublin, Ireland. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you getting on today?
I'm good. Good morning, and thank you very much for having me on.
Very welcome. Nice to have you on.
So let's kick off by asking you about your career background. It's always good to know, so take it away.
Yeah, sure. It's usually a thing where people will have from an early age, I knew what I wanted to be. I don't have that kind of story. I have gone through various different parts of the IT landscape. I've been a sysadmin, I've been a DBA. I worked in a children's hospital doing project management, but I ended up putting in the infrastructure to actually fiber optically cable a children's hospital in the mid-1990s. So I've been through a whole gamut of different things that we do. My most recent raise, I'm about 6 years in Microsoft working in Azure engineering. And before that, I was a product manager in Citrix, where I owned diagnostic and telemetry for the group.
Nice. Sounds good. So you're part of the current leadership team for the Microsoft European Development Center, EDC. So tell us about what you do day to day in your current role, Michael.
Yeah, like any big organization, you get to wear a few different hats as part of your daily work. So my day-to-day stuff is I work on the Azure CXP group, and CXP is a dedicated part of Azure engineering. But on the site-wide function, I'm a member of the board for the EDC, the European Development Center. So based in Dublin, we have our campus is about 2,500 people in it, and we have this big flagship building that it's a bit like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. It's just an amazing entity. But in that, we also have a significant developer entity of about 600 staff across all of the major Microsoft product lines. And we're actually moving to a bespoke engineering building once COVID has passed and we're all heading back to the office. So we've next door to our flagship campus building, we've built this bespoke engineering building for 700-800 engineers to have a full immersive engineering experience. And the EDC basically is responsible for the remit of engineering across European Development Center and the expansion and supporting of all the Microsoft functions.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't actually know there was developers in that part of Ireland. That's cool.
It's one of those things. Microsoft, any particular place you go to, it's the largest software company in the world, and development is always going to be an implicit part of almost every region where we have major functions.
That's cool. So you mentioned the CXP program. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, the CXP is the day job and the main day-to-day thing that I work on. CXP is an interesting premise, and it's the reason why I joined Microsoft was the description of this role. And it really resonated with me for a lot of experience I've had with major engineering works in the industry. CXP is a dedicated part of engineering, but what it's dedicated to is the fundamental premise that you can change the customer's experience of your product or your platform outside of just the direct normal engineering work that you do. And there's an analogy that I overuse in interviews and everything else, so people may have heard me say this before, but if you're standing on a platform and you're waiting for a train and the train takes 5 minutes and you're in a hurry, it can feel like forever. And if you add something as simple as just a countdown clock, then it no longer feels as bad. And you have changed the experience of the delay of the train for the customer without changing the fact that a delay happened. And so there's all many, many, many different touch points where we can fundamentally enhance the customer's experience as they leverage our platform and our products.
I like that. Yeah, me too. That's cool.
And like, there's very specifics on it. There's certain things that like customers won't see because they're things that we do internally. And then there's bits external to the company that they'll be quite aware of. But everything from when customers join the platform, there's services to help them on board, help them do architecture. There's services that are dedicated to very specific commercial entities in certain regions because they have needs that are very different from the standard customer. But the main day-to-day work that I do, or that my direct reporting group does, is we work on the crisis and communications part for customers in Azure. And that bit, anyone who's leveraged the Azure platform should at least be aware of it exists. We have a public status page, and we also send messages directly to customers in their portal. And anytime anything you need to know happens related to workloads in the Azure platform, if it's one customer, a million customers, maintenance notification, if your virtual machine has been inadvertently rebooted, all of that is handled by the CXP group worldwide. And for 8 hours of the day, that runs from our operations room in Dublin, but we have a full failback policy and we've been working from home, obviously, for the last 6-7+ months.
Mm. Nice. I get quite a few of those every now and again, especially recently with the few issues that we've had. So they've been helpful, very helpful. So thanks for all of the hard work on them.
Yeah, you're no problem at all. An interesting thing as part of this, and it's one of those why Microsoft moments. I'm not a fan person that says, oh, my company is the best, but there is a very interesting thing in that Microsoft espouses certain things and then it follows up on them. So Satya, who's our CEO, talks about our commitment to transparency because there's a contract of trust for customers. If you put your services in our cloud, there's a bit that's now out of your control. Where you used to be able to go to your server room and shake the person who's doing your databases, you don't have that now. So we have a commitment to transparency. And that includes where we are unsure, we will over-communicate. And we will, what is the best outcome on behalf of customers? We have a public dashboard and we use it. And we're not afraid to, oh, if we post on our public dashboard, you know, millions of customers are operating absolutely fine and a small amount of them aren't. That's not our concern. Our concern is the transparency to do what's best on behalf of customers. And getting information out is by far the best thing you can do. And if you over-communicate to make sure everyone's reached, that's acceptable.
Yeah, over-communication is definitely a great thing to have. So that's awesome. So based on all of that, how do you prepare for the unexpected?
It's an interesting thing. There's a lot of stuff that you do. It's implicit behavior. And then when you get stretched or tested a little bit, you realize that you had a specific purpose or a specific plan. And for me, the time of COVID and all the activities we did there brought a focus on how we prepare for the unexpected. And it's basically done in layers of preparing for individual things not doing what you want. So if you take the landscape of doing lifecycle communications for Azure, which is certainly the most fundamental and uninterruptible part of the work that we do in Dublin, we'll start with, we work in a building, do we have absolutely resilient power supplies? And there's groups that take care of that. We have, there's generators, battery supply, all the different things that you would expect from a major multinational. So in terms of our connectivity, our ability to fail over, all the things that the building can supply, that's fine. But you have to think, okay, what if those elements in the building don't work in spite of preparations? Or what if we can't go to the building? And what if we can't go to the building was a theoretical thing where people went, what if we couldn't go to the building? A couple of years ago, we had a major snowstorm in Ireland, which is quite rare. But a tropical storm met a hurricane directly over the country and dumped about like 6 feet of snow in the space of a few hours. And we couldn't go to the building. And then suddenly we went, oh, planning for not going to the building was a good idea. Excellent. And that's the thing. You plan for stuff that you hope will never happen. But the way we do it is we look through individual parts, every single thing that we depend on. So we have a rotation of people who cover what we call DRI, the responsible individual, on call for the 8 hours each day. And every single person who covers DRI will also have a portable internet device, a MiFi device, and they are attached to a specific mobile phone network provider. But then every person on our team has their cell phone attached to different providers. And that sounds like a level of detail that's absolutely overkill. But during COVID, everyone has moved home. And a major provider for home internet that covers probably more than 50% of the market had an outage. It's quite rare. We all know like the infrastructure in most of our countries is very resilient. But they had an outage and it went for 2 or 3 hours. But we had multiple people working remotely whose home internet was impacted. But they could instantly switch to a mobile device provider, which was by planning completely separate to the company that was doing the home internet. And if the mobile device provider had been impacted, their cell phone was again on a different provider. So you have multiple layers of resilience for connectivity with a small amount of planning. But it just gets you a little bit further into, like some people say it's, you plan for it by being paranoid about everything, but paranoid's probably a not nice term to use for it. You just need to be aware that anything can fail. And what do I do next?
Yeah, that's good. I like the idea of having the MiFi device on one network, your mobile on another, and then your home internet on a different provider altogether. Because here in the UK, you've got BT, which is part of the EE, and they all sort of merge in together here. So you've got to try and figure out how to separate it all. So that's cool. So let's just move on a bit to about understanding SLAs and shared responsibilities in the cloud, because you sort of mentioned that a bit earlier. So I want to sort of get your thoughts about that.
Yeah, SLA is an interesting and very misunderstood thing. So if you mind, I might drill into it just a little bit in terms of certainly how I see it from inside engineering looking out. SLA, service level agreement, is an expression of the level of service you can expect from a company that you have a contract with. And in cloud computing, typically it's an expression of uptime. And every person who operates in services with SLA, the company offers an SLA that they know statistically, we can stand over this. You are very, very, very likely to experience this or a better level of service. And usually they come with some sort of, there is some financial recompense to customers if we don't meet our SLA in a certain given period. But when you think about cloud computing and what people use it for, I sometimes talk to customers if they have been impacted by an outage and different things that we can do. But the main takeaway is a customer does not want to get payment on an SLA. And a company that offers an SLA does not want to be paying it. Because if you put your services in the cloud and something doesn't work for you, that's impacting your business. And a payment related to an SLA is really not of interest to you. It's good that the company you're buying your service from offers SLA and puts a financial backing behind it. But that's not how you run your business. So what we get into then is SLO and SLI. And the focus on that, a lot of companies are starting to come around to it now. And when you get into that, that's where you get into the balance of responsibility. I'll give a very simple example. So Azure was one of the first, I think it was the first major cloud provider to offer an SLA on what we call a single instance virtual machine. So it's just a virtual machine running in the cloud. Press a button and it starts. And the levers of resilience built into our data centers, operations, everything meant that we could offer what's known as a 99.9% SLA. 99.9% SLA, that 0.1 for people who don't specialize in doing quick maths on the top of their head, accounts to about 8 hours, 45 minutes possible non-availability in an entire year. So it's a very small amount. And people might use a single instance virtual machine and go, haha, I'm absolutely okay with that 0.1. I mean, middle of the night, even if we have a reboot, I don't mind. But in Ireland, we have a thing we call Murphy's Law. If something is going to impact you, it can often happen at the least opportune time. And if you think my machine, everything's been resilient, running perfectly for 6 months straight, and I'm just having a major Black Friday sale, and I get an instance, an outage that impacts me for 45 minutes. 45 minutes probably doesn't even trigger an SLA. But for you in the middle of a Black Friday sales window, it's suddenly, oh my goodness, I've lost whatever amount of, say it's a very big website, I've lost $100,000 per hour. And then suddenly your understanding of what you want, the SLA that's offered to you, and the SLO, the difference between them becomes very apparent. Because SLO is the objective that you want to meet for your service. And that's where a customer has to think about that. When you move to cloud services, a lot of companies do what's called lift and shift, where they go, okay, I'm an expert in what I do. I have my IT staff. We were running it in our data center, and now we put it in the cloud. Absolutely, it works. But the reason to leverage cloud is not just it's a cheaper way of doing it, or you know, their data centers are more resilient. It offers you the basics of near infinite resources. If you press a button, you can get something. Whereas in your data center, you got to place an order with a provider, wait till it ships, unbox it, configure it. Once it's in the cloud, that's all taken care of. And you press a button, you can have another machine. And then you pay per minute for what you use. The flexibility that gives you is you can think, right, I will have two machines running in tandem, as a very simple example. It's a bit more expensive, but if anything happens whatsoever to machine A, the machine B is still running. Maybe that expense is worthwhile. Whereas if you're doing it in on-premises, you're going, well, you know, it doesn't make sense in my own data center. When you move to the cloud, there's an enormous amount of resilience options made available to you. So we have things like availability sets, where you can put machines in multiple sets where, you know, maintenance and power redundancy is completely separate for where each of those machines is hosted. So a single event causing an impact to one virtual machine is guaranteed not to impact the other. And then we have availability zones where we isolate entire data centers. So every single thing about them is separate. So two data centers beside each other, barring an actual geographic event, nothing is going to impact the two data centers at the same time. And then you've got regional resiliency where you can actually run your event, one workload in West Europe and one workload in North Europe. And you're then hundreds of kilometers apart. So each of those has a different level of spend associated with it. But if you're a company that works very hard and understands what SLO is, and you know, during a Black Friday sale, maybe I scale up and scale out my architecture to make sure I don't fail. And then when you haven't failed, maybe you can scale back down afterwards if you don't need the same level of resilience, but you've avoided impact, financial, brand, or otherwise, at your most critical time.
Yeah, that's awesome. And obviously with Azure, you get, like I said, all that flexibility to be able to do that. So it's just amazing that you can do that so easily.
Yeah, it's a thing, like there is a certain amount, if you start doing provision for customers and you think, like when Azure started, it was a little over 10 years ago, and obviously it was major customers that we knew were the first people on the platform. But you fast forward 10 years and we have millions of customers and billions of end users. And this has to be something that our customers understand the level of resilience they need. Engineering, extreme rigor, all the stuff that we do. We have over 200 data centers. We have 60 something regions that we operate out of. New regions were announced publicly yesterday, last week. It's a very fast growing environment. And we're bringing data centers and near grid connectivity closer and closer to major population centers all the time. But in the end, the way a customer wants to experience your platform, some of that is the resilience you bring, and then some of that is the architecture the customer needs to decide to configure. And when we get that balance right with customers, it's a very, very good alignment.
That's cool, because they also just announced the containerized Azure, so you can put in your car park or stuff from the looks of it, which is quite cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things. If you notice, we're quite good at explaining and talking about things that we're doing theoretically and things that are not yet product launches. So we have Project Natick, which got a lot of attention, which is we containerized a mini data center and sank it under the ocean. And the whole point of that was, no, we're not putting all our data centers under the ocean, but we're constantly doing evolution in how we think and understand these things should work. Because we sank that under the ocean, left it there for, I think, 2 years. And the first thing was people joking about, like, engineers in scuba diving suits to service machines. But actually, we built planned obsolescence in that we know there's a certain amount of hardware will fail. Everyone knows that. Software can have bugs, hardware can have failures. If you sink a data center in a contained unit underseas, you're okay with a certain amount of it eventually not working. And then after a couple of years, you bring it back out again. But it needed no other human intervention for that very extended period of time. And that is a way of proving to us how we can change data center operations. Maybe we'll eventually do large data centers that are, you know, near water, attached to water, underwater. The future is a very exciting place, but very unknown. But we're very happy to share with people the different things that we're trying, even on a theoretical basis, because we're part of a common society. And knowing that Microsoft is very embedded into making stuff work more green, we've given our commitments globally to be carbon neutral. And now we're talking about being water neutral and other things like that. So we've given very public statements. And part of that is showing public, again, as part of our contract of transparency, here's some stuff we're trying. Here's some experiments we're doing. Here's some stuff that, yeah, it may work or may not. And that's a very interesting space to be in.
Sounds like you've got a very, very interesting job, Michael. Just before we move on, real quick, mm-hmm. You mentioned SLA and SLO. What's SLI?
SLA is service level agreement. SLO is service level objective. SLI is service level indicator. Right. And if you think about that, there's a couple of ways to analyze this. One is, if I take Azure as a platform all up, we will publish some what they call SLA numbers. And actually internally, we're currently reviewing how we understand that as well. Because a broad SLA number for a customer, hey, we achieved 99.9, many, many nines, possibly an 8 at the very end. The customer goes, okay, but I want to know my experience of the platform. And SLI is where customers get into monitoring of their specific instances, because you can have impact and outages in any IT system. And for a customer, A, understanding their real experience of the platform. If you take a single instance virtual machine, you could run for the entire year and have no interruptions whatsoever. So you've achieved 100%. That's not what we can sell. And 100% is not a permanently achievable thing. Anyone who says they can offer you 100% is not basing that on actual reality. But if a customer gets into SLIs and we can expose SLIs to customers and they can understand how they've experienced our platform, then with an SLI, you know, are you really truly empowering the SLOs that you've measured?
Right, cool. Now, I just wanted to check, because I'd heard of SLA and SLO, but I wasn't sure about SLI.
Okay. SLI is the honesty part at the end where you measure.
Yeah, I mean, I'd imagine a lot of customers are kind of wanting to keep track of that. I know a lot of our customers would be more interested in SLI than SLAs, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is work, like every question you ask in Azure, I can say, there's work ongoing, because there is. We fundamentally change how our customers experience our platform all the time. But one of the things that we are looking at the moment is self-service elements through Azure Monitor and other parts of our infrastructure we can expose to customers and how they can get insights by themselves. You don't want Microsoft providing you insights. You want to be able to self-service and go, this is how I have experienced it. And so there's ongoing work in those areas, and there's updates for customers regularly on different features that are available.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's going to be very powerful. Okay, so let's move on a little bit. So you were talking about before about data centers. So how do Microsoft ensure that data centers are green and keep emissions low, et cetera? That must be a problem of different parts around the world.
It is a concern rather than a problem, I'd say. But so data centers, I will add a caveat. It's not my area of expertise. We leverage them heavily, but I'm not in the physical data center area. But I do know a lot of the work that we do. An interesting thing as part of training that I do for people a lot is I do an overview for new hires of company culture, why we do what we do, the scale we operate. And one of them is an aerial shot of one of our regions, and it has about four different data centers. And the most common question is, why do they all look so different? We iterate on our data center design every single time we build a data center. And the data centers that we build are bespoke for the region that they're built in. So we have certain data centers that will be built and run and operate permanently in hot climates. We have data centers that are built in, like Ireland is in a cool maritime climate. And taking advantage of the local environment and making sure that the design matches it is a huge part of making sure that data centers use the minimum resources required to provide what customers need. If you're going to build a data center in the desert, then okay, there's going to be a huge amount of solar available. That's a massive oversimplification, but you get the idea. In terms of the different designs that we do as well, it's also in terms of efficiency and how data centers run. And we have had designs where we've containerized entire clusters and scale units and parts of the data center where they arrive pre-built and can just be plugged in. We've had other ones where essentially we've built cooling into the building itself so we don't use mechanical refrigeration. And each of those allowed us to take a step further towards being as least resource consuming as possible. And in the end, that's like, we all know there's now a global mandate. We need to get better at all the things that we do. It's a good thing there's a spotlight on data centers and cloud operations, because you can look at it and say, how many megawatts does that consume? It consumes the same as a small city. This, and people are right to be concerned about that. But there's published papers for Azure, and I presume other main cloud providers too. But they've already worked out that if you take the data center operations of multiple businesses that they were running on-premise and move them into the cloud, it's fundamentally a lower carbon emission way of doing the same work, because the economies of scale and the expertise that comes with using the latest possible data infrastructure and design gives a massive reduction in what we do. And then also with the scale that Microsoft operates at, it in certain regions, and again, there's lots of public stuff that people can look up on this, we're buying into solar, we're buying into wind farms, we're buying into all sustainable ways of generating electricity. And probably the last one I call out, and this varies massively depending on each country, but I know in a lot of countries we partner closely with the grid operators as well. As a large consumer of power on the grid, we're also a large generator of power. We have battery installations, we have backup generators, we have all the different things that you expect. So by partnering with the local power grid, we can help the actual infrastructure for that region, city, or country understand our needs and also to plan around them and our peak times versus customer peak times. And that gets you into the bit where the grid infrastructure in the country can operate much more flexibly because they understand the exact requirements of a major consumer.
That's quite cool. I didn't know you worked so closely with the grids. That's really cool. So talking about data centers, when obviously part of your job is the communication side of when there's an issue. Do you ever like get called out of hours or anything like that when something goes wrong, or do you have other teams that handle that for you?
So out of hours isn't a thing for the CXP group anymore. We originally started doing this. Obviously, Microsoft is a very heavy Redmond-centric focus because that's headquarters. There's like more than 50,000 people work in Redmond. It's basically a city. But Dublin was the first step for Azure, particularly in CXP, outside of Redmond. So we operated 12-hour shifts originally when we started doing this. We now have a full scaled follow the sun model. We have an office based in Sydney where we have fully staffed out engineering for a lot of our Azure functions as well. So we run 8 hours of the day and then we hand over, and we have three handovers that take place per day for each team to make sure that there's continuity. We have had out of hours calls. We do have emergency response. Every entity that's the size and scale of what Azure does has to be prepared for the unknown. So the likelihood of being called out of hours now is very low because we've built that into our normal run the business operations. But our ability to be called out of hours and our emergency alerting is still a process that is fundamentally reviewed and that we regularly test to make sure it works.
Cool. I like that. That's good. Follow the sun, you know. That's very clever to do. I wish more companies did that.
There's a thing which is, like you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of exciting things that we do, but there's a human element to all of this. And part of that is, it doesn't matter how great the group of people you have is, if you're not supporting people in ways that encapsulate the fact that we are all humans, you are doing this wrong. And yes, we had, like, at the beginning days, we were doing 12-hour shifts out of Dublin, but that was with a very defined process to getting us to a follow the sun model. And once we get to a follow the sun model, people can experience all the exciting things, cool things, data centers underwater, all the amazing stuff that happens in Azure, but they need to experience it in such a way that they went, and then I went home on Friday evening and I relaxed for the weekend and nobody annoyed me and I did pottering in my garden. Whatever constitutes the rest of your life has to function as well. The excitement and all the cool things. There's no end to the amount of work that you can do in an entity the size of Azure, but if you give your staff the framework in which they can balance what they do and you make sure that work does not over ask of them, then a year's time, hopefully most of your staff will still be here, still be excited, and that expertise is still available to our customers.
Yeah, that's very important. So, Michael, what is the most challenging part of your job?
A part one of it is being prepared for the unknown, because, you know, the unknown is unknown, and we've kind of delved a little bit into how you prepare for what you know you rely on. Actually, when we have, like, crisis moments will happen for any major IT provider, outages can happen. I know you mentioned that you've received communications on a few before. Having rigor and process around that actually makes that not a spectacularly difficult thing to deal with, but something that we have to handle extremely carefully. There's certain contradictions in what we try to do when you work in communications for crisis, because you want to send the most accurate message to the most precise group of people in the shortest amount of time. And fundamentally, they are somewhat contradictory goals. Because at the very beginning, if you have some impact on a platform, you want to send a message to customers, you don't necessarily know, you know, 1 minute into some impact, who is impacted. And the challenging part for us, and the bit that we iterate on and have a huge amount of engineering resources behind, is changing how we fundamentally detect, understand, and interact when there are outages. We've put an enormous amount of work into automation because in the end, the human element is very useful for supervision, oversight, and understanding stuff's working precisely. But if you're doing stuff manually in 2015, in 2020, you should have easily evolved out of the manual element of that, taken the expertise that the manual oversight gave you, and built automation to make that work better. Azure more than it grows very quickly. I'm not too sure what the public statement that is. But Azure grows extremely quickly and is the second largest cloud provider in the world, and it's the fastest expanding. And if you were to expand staff in a linear manner with the growth of the cloud, we would be filling buildings and countries all over the world. But that's not in any way scalable, and it's not an efficient way to use resources. Managing the storage resources for 1,000 customers or 100,000 customers shouldn't be a linear expansion of staff. So as we invest in automation and process and rigor, we scale to how the cloud grows, and we also scale to improving the experience customers have of it. And that's probably the most challenging part, because you need to balance how far you wish to go with automation and efforts to increase the reliability, resilience, and the content and customer signal that we send out. But you also don't want to go too far of it that customers get a generic message that is in no way tailored to their needs and does not reflect their reality. So I'd say the balancing of those, and we put an awful lot of effort into it, and I think we're certainly on a good trajectory, but every day is a learning day, and the time you think you're finished and have something perfect is the time you'll find out the next day you really didn't. So that's probably my take on the bits. It's quite challenging.
Yeah, the always thinking you finished and then realizing you haven't is always fun.
Yeah.
But talking about fun and best parts of your job, what are the actual best parts of your job?
I'm going to sound like an awful, it's the expression fanboy for everyone who sees this. There's a lot of things in the job that are interesting and lots of new technology. But I say the best part about the job is part of when I joined, they were saying what CXP was. They were launching it overseas. The fact that, okay, we're fundamentally going to focus on the customer experience, not just engineering, because engineering already has massive dedicated work streams for that. But I joined a company where a new CEO had taken over, a chap called Satya, and it was, we did a vision to empower every person and organization on the planet to do more. And there's statements from our CEO over all the time about what we do, being responsible, moral obligations. And the best part about the job is that is tangible for us in our day-to-day work. So we get to work with cool technologies with lots of excitement. But when the CEO says that, you know, we are going to focus on these things, we are going to work much better. There's obviously in certain countries in the world, there's been a lot of focus on diversity, racism, inclusivity, and all those things. They are talking points for major companies. But what we see is tangible actions and staff being empowered to own parts of that equation. So it doesn't matter if you're an entry-level college graduate all the way up to like a CVP in Microsoft, you know that you own part of the fundamentals of how the company operates, and you get to report up on it. You get to talk to your boss about it, and mentoring one-to-ones and that experience is all inclusive about how staff perceive what their ideas are and what we could do differently.
Sounds like I've got a great job, to be honest. Okay, so moving on a little bit, I had a wee look into your career on LinkedIn. So I see that you worked at Citrix.
Yes.
You took part in a Global Day of Impact, GDI Day, and you were volunteering projects in the community. Tell us a little bit about that, because I'm always interested in doing stuff in the community.
Ah, excellent. Definitely really interesting stuff. So it was an interesting part when I joined. I was in Citrix for about 5 years, and when I'd been there for about a year, Citrix had a big thing in terms of volunteering. There wasn't much sign, there was a little bit of it happening in Dublin. And I reached out to the person who was running the program globally. And I said, well, you know, what's the story with this? And they said, oh, we have a program, we have funding, you know, it's not big take up. You have a program and funding and there's not a big take up. Hi, my name's Michael. Really nice to meet you. And we started from there and we essentially went, okay, we've got funding. And I went with the objective from major corporations when they have funding for these things, they tie it into staff effort because they want it to be a thing that staff participate in. It's not just a company giving money. And I have to say kudos to Citrix for the way that they did that, because it encouraged staff to be involved in reaching out to the community and understanding what's going on. But I'm quite an annoyingly organized person, and many, many people who work with me will tell you that. But I just went, right, well then, if we have a certain amount of budget, I got a framework in which we could use it. I went, right, we need opportunities. The interesting thing is opportunities to volunteer are actually kind of difficult to find. Because everybody will say, oh, yeah, we can use volunteers. And then he's going, right, what do you want us to do? And they go, oh. So it went from a, hey, we want to volunteer and do something nice, to understanding, oh, now I know why people don't volunteer that often, because actually there's a bit of work into getting it. So I went, right, we'll create a volunteer program. I'll organize opportunities with companies and people can sign up for it. And then we ended up, we were providing hundreds of volunteer days in organizations. And we could bring some funding to the game. Certainly, we were doing some of this in like 2010, 11, where a financial crash had happened. A lot of like really worthwhile institutions had lost lots of their funding, or fundraising wasn't going as well. So we could say, they say, oh, we'd love someone to paint, but we have no money for paint. We can solve that problem. We can pay for paint and turn up. And there was a tendency, like a bunch of IT people were like, no, we'll go in and we'll redesign the IT infrastructure and we'll set up a like Citrix product Zen server for this company. But like, no, that's getting into an area where we're just repeating our day job. What we actually need to do is go out and experience the community and understand where we all live. And we did that, and we went out and we worked in, there's a children's hospice that's quite near to where I live, and they had volunteer opportunities, but we understood then the fundamental society. It's the only hospice for children in Ireland, and they deal with like some heartbreaking conditions, and they do very well at fundraising, but people in the community need to understand they're there, they need to understand what they do, and we need to help. And then we started volunteering at schools, other organizations, and we ended up with just a remit of work where a load of companies knew, hey, Citrix is volunteering and helping and funding, and it's embedded in our community. And hundreds of staff in the company got to see, outside of my daily commute and the narrow window of society that I normally see, all these things exist and all these things are important and all these things I should know more about. So it balanced really well. And I think everybody participated and it really got a fundamentally, not a life-changing experience, but certainly an eye-opening experience of the world that exists around them and how we can just do a little better.
Yeah, that's brilliant. There's not enough of that in the world, I don't think. So hats off to you for doing that.
One of the... Probably I should, for full disclosure, when I moved over to Microsoft, it's like a much larger scale organization, and they had an amazing volunteer program and huge number of people already running it. And I went, excellent. And I played the lazy card and I didn't get directly involved in the volunteering for running that. But they do a lot of fundraising and a lot of activities there. And like, so one local, the actual hospice that I mentioned, interestingly, Microsoft often do volunteer work as well. And they do, over the last 4 years of doing charity cycles, they've raised like €500,000 by staff doing charity cycles. And again, volunteer days, all that stuff exists. And it's one of the big things. Obviously, I really, really like the company that I work for. Microsoft's a fantastic place. Most multinationals will provide volunteer days. A lot of them will have budgets, charity matching. And if anyone listening to this is in a multinational, check out what they do have to offer and check out whether you can participate, because multinationals do it in a certain way that they want staff behavior to follow, not just that they're giving money, but you can have a huge impact by doing it.
Good show.
So earlier you mentioned that you are very, very organized. I also noticed on your LinkedIn, I think it was, that you're a certified Scrum Master. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. So when I was working doing the product management function based in Citrix, I have an IT background. I, you know, have a master's in some IT disciplines, etc. But coding is not a huge part of what I've done. And most people regularly agree that technically I know how to code, but I shouldn't ever do it professionally. But when you're working with large software development, which is a big part of most IT multinationals, understanding fundamentally how to organize, how to triage, how to process, how to prioritize is a skill that most people should have. And the Scrum process, initially I knew a reasonable amount about it, but formal certification, I chatted to my boss about it, and eventually he went, okay, if you stop annoying me, we'll fund it, off you go. I went in, but it actually changed how I operate, because it gives you a step back from evaluating stuff. There's a really silly example I use for when people are talking about how you use Scrum. And it's like, if someone lined up a variety of dogs and said, can you tell me what each of them weigh? You just look, no, I guess 10 kilos, I don't know. But if you change the question, you said, can you line them up in order of how much they weigh? Most people will go, yeah, I think so. And that's the thing, like, we sometimes focus when we're running projects and managing strategy, vision, and long-term stuff on the details we don't have or what we can't do. But there's usually an enormous amount we do know that will allow us to get started. The biggest story that comes around with Scrum that you hear quite a bit was, I think it was credit union institutions were trying to put in a global IT system. And after X number of years, it was a failure and it was deemed like a large amount of money being spent, but it never got off the ground. And it's one of the stories that's used in Scrum because they were trying to tackle an overall problem without understanding the fundamental components. And usually that can be applied to everything you work on. Like Scrum approach to how we do making sure that everything was resilient and available in LifeSite, they're quite compatible. And because you can start with an epic, the overall thing that you want to do, and then you break it into stories and into tasks. And when you get down to that level of detail, most stuff becomes manageable and you can track progress and you know that you're actually achieving stuff and making progress. So yeah, for me, it was a bit of a turning point in my career in terms of I found a framework that matched how I like to think about stuff. Every problem is solvable or a workaround is achievable, but how to break it down and how to understand it. So, yeah, for people who haven't done it, I highly encourage it. It's a really good course to do.
Yeah, I mean, I worked at the world's largest bank, and we had one or two Scrum Masters, and to be honest, they didn't make a massive difference. But then we got our third Scrum Master who knew the stuff inside out. And I was always a bit wary and dubious of Scrum Masters, but to be honest, if you know it and you're good at your job, it made a massive difference on our project. It really did. We were kind of like what you were saying about the other company. We were heading in a direction and nobody really knew what was happening. And this guy came in and basically took a step back and kind of redid the process. And it made an enormous difference in our project. It was pretty interesting when you see it working well.
Yeah, there's a step back that you can do. The difference between, yes, I know everybody's very busy, but what are we actually achieving? That's a really big thing that comes up. And that's probably the experience you had with this as well.
Yeah, as we were actually finding, we were doing 2 week sprints and we couldn't get all the work done. And then the guy came in and basically took a step back, looked at what everyone was doing. And it turns out, hey, you're in meetings 40% of the time that a lot of people think are a waste of time. So yeah, Scrum Master's definitely an interesting role. But if you've got a good Scrum Master, it can make a huge difference. Right, okay, so we've got a couple more questions left to go. Michael, what's your favourite place in the world that someone might not have heard of?
That's an interesting one. So first of all, I'm based in Ireland. So pre-COVID times, we have a tendency, because Ireland is quite a small island, that, you know, if you want guaranteed sunshine, you're going to get on a plane. if you want to go skiing, you're going to get on a plane. And there's a certain amount of things that we spend a lot of time just flying out of Ireland to find. But the staycation thing, obviously, for everybody has become a much bigger thing. And it's brought a little bit focus on back what's happening local. There's a big changes in terms of cycling infrastructure and how we're all experiencing our cities going on. And one I'd call out that's happened in Ireland, we had at one stage, I think the most, I don't know what the term is, but the largest amount of railway per head of population in the world somewhere in the 18th century. It was like the railway network was very well developed under when we were part of the British Empire. And a lot of that fell into disrepair, the 1950s, the advent of the motor car as the future. But an interesting thing started happening in the last 10 years, which is they started taking the old railway lines, which outside of the city still exist, they're just not used, and making them into cycleways. And they're now they've done parts of it, and you know, it's an ongoing work, but they're connecting different parts of the country. We get 20, 40, 50 kilometers of cycle route through amazing countryside, along across massive viaducts through valleys, all the major engineering works that were done hundreds of years ago. And you can be completely detached from the road network, towns, villages, and you just drop in and visit. So there's one in Waterford called a Greenway that like does 50, 60 kilometers. They're currently working on a cycle path that connects Dublin to Galway. And yeah, that's about a 200 kilometer journey. But actually for people who are a little bit into cycling, you know, if you're crazy into cycling, obviously you can do that in a day, but you could take a day or two, stop in individual nice towns, some of it cycling alongside the old canals across the country. And that's probably a thing I take away, because it is part of the staycation thing. And it's part of the remembering that you exist, you know, your country is a really cool place to travel and go to too. So yeah, that'd probably be it for me, just the stuff that is coming up. And I think we all got a little bit more of an environmental focus in the last certainly 12 months anyway. And the idea of being able to do a vacation, a trip on bicycle, but do it in a framework where you're like, I'm happy for my kids to cycle 200 yards in front of me because I'm nowhere near a road and we're all safe and it's beautiful. So yeah, I'd go with that.
That's a good answer. Like it.
Yeah, definitely good. So my sort of fun, not work related question is, what do you do in your spare time? I'm guessing it might be cycling, but I will let you answer.
So you say spare time, LinkedIn doesn't mention, I have children, so spare time. So I've done quite a few random things. I was at one stage quite a committed marathon runner. I've done like 10 or 12 marathons in different cities. And I am not an avid cyclist, but I do like pastime cycling, you know, going out for a few hours cycle on a Sunday afternoon. I don't do a huge amount of that now at the moment. It's very busy with kids. But that's not a complaint, because actually kids are small and they're only small for a certain amount of time. So I do an awful lot of, I'm becoming indoctrinated into the world of Minecraft and Roblox, and I do an awful lot of playing things with just, again, it's reminding you a little bit of the fun things you've forgotten, like running, you know, doing stuff in the field. All of that's fun. And as grown-ups, we kind of just boringly trudge to work and then we do our tasks. And yeah, so I'm immersing myself a little bit in remembering how much fun it can be to be a kid.
Nice, like that. Right, we asked this question to all of our guests. If you could pick someone you know who isn't well known to kind of everyone else and would be amazing to get on a podcast, who would you choose and why?
Oh.
Someone you've worked with or a friend or someone who's done something really interesting that nobody's really aware of.
That's a good question. Probably a slightly non-sequitur or at least slightly right angle answer to that. But I'd actually say, so we do a lot of it, particularly in my current job at Microsoft, we do an awful lot of work in terms of the community, in terms of STEM, schools, gender balance, all the different things that we're just trying to be a positive influence in terms of how the community works. I think a fantastic thing for you to interview would actually be a local school, something like that. Find a STEM advocate teacher, someone working at a school level, you know, working with age 10 to late teenager kids, and find out what the landscape's like for them. Because there's a lot of stuff that we do in technology and it's built upon meeting people who found a love of what they do in technology and, you know, they're already in there. But understanding where nurturing that comes from, I think that'd be a fantastic podcast. And I think all of us would discover stuff in that we just simply aren't aware of.
Brilliant idea. Love it.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to look into that. So that's pretty much all we've got time for today. So a massive, huge, big thank you to you for coming on the show today. Being really insightful and amazing talking to you. So I hope everyone enjoyed today's show, and we look forward to bringing you more episodes in the future.